I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guests are Snap Judgment creator Glenn Washington, 99% Invisible creator Roman Mars, and cartoonist and writer Jessica Abel. And now join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Glenn Washington, Roman Mars, and Jessica Abel. So tonight, we are so excited. We have Jessica Abel here, who's written Out on the Wire. She is joined by Roman Mars and Glenn Washington. Jessica is also the author of two textbooks about making comics, the graphic novel La Perdida, and she's working on a science fiction comic series, Trish Trash, Roller Girl of Mars. So thinking about that, let's welcome Jessica, Roman, and Glenn.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Welcome. Okay, so why don't you tell us who you are and what you do and maybe how long you've been doing it and the origin story of your show.
My name is Glenn Washington. And I'm super glad. So there's some snappers in the audience. I have one of the most unlikely origin stories in public media. There was a This American Idol style contest, and I won. And about 2 years after that, we got to pull the trigger on the first season of Snap. And I'll kick it over to my brother here, but just to know how. If you ever wondered, someone says Glenn is not wise, he doesn't know what he's talking about. My first hire
was me. That is true. That is very true.
So I cried real tears when he said he was leaving us forever.
And so I'm Roman Mars. I produce 99% Invisible. So I started 99% Invisible as my night job when I was working at Snap Judgment. And it just started snowballed into something that began to require my attention. And that's how it really began, is this little segment on KALW into this podcast and this whole thing that it is today. It's amazing to me at this point still.
And just to go how incestuous this is, One of the early inspirations for Snap Judgment was a show on KLW called Invisible Ink.
Don't applaud that.
I saw a T-shirt here earlier. Oh, right here. Yeah. which was started by Roman Mars.
Yep. Yep.
Circles within circles. No, circles seriously. One day I want to tell your origin story in comics. So I've been making comics for 25 years now, sort of unbelievably, and started out doing fiction, entirely fiction, doing short stories and doing mini comics and stuff like that, and then I started doing some nonfiction in the 90s, and it was as a result of that that Ira Glass called me when I was living in Mexico City in 1998 and asked me to do Radio and Illustrated Guide, which is a 30-page floppy comic that we put out in 99 about how This American Life made and really still makes their show. What are the stages? How does it actually go through this process? And then I left it for 15 years or 12 years or something and did a whole bunch of other stuff, including more fiction comics and two big textbooks on comics, and then teaching storytelling for 12 years. And all of a sudden, it seemed like a really good idea to go back and look at what was going on in radio, since I had been thinking about storytelling so intensely, basically, since Radio and Illustrated Guide.
And what was your process in writing this book? How did you decide who to interview? How did you do that?
Well, I I had a meeting with Ira Glass and Seth Lind at This American Life, and I was talking to them initially about expanding radio and Illustrated Guide. And as soon as I brought that to Ira, and he's like, oh, yeah, good idea. He's like, what do you have in mind? And I was like, I don't know, like 100 pages, you know. He's like, no, absolutely not, because it just is so much work. Like, the first book was just so much work. And he didn't want to get involved in that again, which I completely understand. He's a busy man. He was creating Serial, doing other stuff. But so we revisited the idea, looked at it again, and both he and I thought about it a little bit. And I don't remember who came up with this idea, but I don't remember. It might have been him who said, why don't you look at other shows that are doing other stuff now? And so we talked about a list of who we thought was doing really great stuff. And they helped me get in touch with Glenn and and Catherine Burns of The Moth and Jay Allison for The Moth Radio Hour. And who else did I initially get in touch with? With Planet Money and... so there's a short list of initial shows that we talked about, and then it kind of expanded out from that a little bit. So when I found out about what Roman was doing, which was during the research period, I got in touch with him immediately and wanted to talk to him. And initially, I wanted to get in touch with you to talk to you about your time with Snap. Right. But while this was all going on, that was when your show was really becoming like a full show. And so it kind of grew from there.
Great. Can you tell us who you wrote the book for?
I guess primarily for people who love this kind of narrative nonfiction radio. I mean, that's the core audience. Not just people who want to make it, although the first book, Radio and Illustrated Guide, really had a sort of like, here's how you make this thing kind of angle. But this new book isn't really that. It's meant to be much more broad, expansive kind of audience where, you know, millions and millions of people love this stuff and listen to it every week. And I wanted to help them understand, why do they love it so much? Why do they sit in their driveways instead of going into their nice warm houses and listen to the end of the stories? I mean, this is it's like a cliche, the driveway moment, but it's absolutely true. It's totally happened to me. This style of storytelling, I mean, there's so many different ways that it can be done. It's not like one style, but like this overall kind of approach, so powerful and so interesting. And I wanted to try to reveal what are the secrets of the new masters. that's the core audience. And then, you know, even larger audience is people who just want to know about storytelling. Because the fact is, once I kind of got into this whole thing and sort of pulled apart these threads, I feel like 90% of what's in the book applies to any kind of storytelling at all. Especially me. You know, like as a cartoonist, I, until very recently, had never made radio, never made audio. And so the process of writing the book was also a process of learning myself what I needed to learn from these guys. And you'll all be very modest about this, I'm sure, but like the thing is, I'm not sure that if you're in the middle of it, you can kind of like see what all the parts are, you know? Like it takes somebody from the outside to look at it and say like, oh, this is what you're doing, and this is like this person, and this is like this. This is different, this is interesting, but you know, mm-hmm. and kind of put all that together. And I had that response from a lot of the people in the book, like, I knew all this stuff, but I didn't know this stuff. You know, it's kind of not laid out in that way. And I felt the same way as a storyteller. Like, as I knew all this stuff. I had done many books before, written many stories. But having to really think through, how am I going to put this down on paper? How am I going to take these pieces apart? Helped me make the book itself, you know?
And what were some of those themes that emerged from the different shows, sort of things that... came across in your interviews?
Would you like to show us some artwork?
Maybe. Let's see. And I want to share, we're going to share a lot of Jessica's illustrations throughout and panels from the book. So,
surprising, engaging characters. authentic voices, which this is not. Robust narrative structure. Okay. And in many cases, intricate uses of sound as a part of storytelling. And especially... right here.
Speaking of sound.
Should we have some sound?
I think we should have some sound. We're going to talk about sound, but it's good to hear back-to-back the two shows for examples. So here is...
But the baby had to come out premature. Mother and child were whisked to a neonatal intensive unit, and only parents were allowed to visit. I was not a parent. But the daddy was on the other side of the world trying to find a plane, and my friend said, I need someone here. So when the nurse asked me, are you the daddy?
Are you the daddy?
I told her, yeah, I'm the daddy. And the nurse, she told me to scrub my hands with soap and the special brush before she took me to the incubator. And she looked like a little baby bird, hooked tubes and wires and monitors, so tiny. My friend, the child's mother, took my hand. I told her to go to sleep. Go on to sleep. Are you sure? Go to sleep. She finally left, and the nurses told me that what a tiny baby under 2 pounds really needs is skin-on-skin contact. What can I do? They told me to strip. They set up a tent, an anti-contamination tent, and sent me wearing nothing but my boxer shorts inside.
So that was Snap Judgment.
I changed my mind. I want to go first.
And here, exclusive, I think you get like 12 hours before being released tomorrow is the first minute of tomorrow's 99% Invisible.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. It was the night of March 30th, 2005, and the Powerball jackpot was $25 million. On TV, the white ping pong balls rolled out one by one as the host announced the winning numbers.
22, 28, 32, 33, 39, and your Powerball is 42.
That's producer Avery Truffleman.
And there was a winner in Tennessee. But the way the Powerball drawings work, there are usually some second place winners who guess all of the numbers except for the very last one. On average, there are three or four of these players.
But on March 30th, 2005, there were 110 second-place winners.
Was there a computer glitch that played all the same number? Like, has someone compromised the system?
This is journalist Jennifer Aitley.
Lottery officials are panicked, you know, because, like, something is up.
So the next day, as the winners around the United States came to collect, the Powerball officials asked them,
so where'd you get your number from?
And each of them had the same answer. They had gotten their numbers from a fortune cookie.
So the stories, both of the stories obviously are leading to very compelling things, but I want to focus on the sound and how you chose, how you came up with what your show should sound like, uses of the different elements and ambient noise and stuff like that. So,
yeah. The idea behind Snap in the beginning was this idea of dual narration. You can't really divorce the sound from the story, but the idea was that let's get rid of the boring stuff and go right to the story. And in order to do that, we needed cues to drop listeners into what we're trying to say, both kind of emotionally and sometimes even intellectually. There's a lots of things. So when we picked this idea, we called it dual narrative audio conceptualization of some nonsense we put down there.
And what is that?
All it is
catchy.
This whole idea.
It is catchy.
It's this brand new idea of story and sound combined. And it's the sound that, what's happened actually is that the technology of sound creation has changed tremendously. For a typical Snap Judgment sort of soundscape, we will have maybe 12 to 14 different tracks of sound. And it's second by second as far as the editing is going. And it just the tools that we have to produce sound with right now are so different. And the idea was to let's go see if we can stretch them to the 11th point and make this show.
I got totally caught.
I mean, I think it's really cinematic what Snap Judgment does. And that's one of the things that I remember from the very beginning, was the use of Foley sound and music that blended together in this really beautiful way that I hadn't heard on the radio for a long time. And when it was done, it was usually done pretty poorly with, like, you know, horses with, you know, coconuts.
So
in that scene that you just played, there's like this really mm-hmm. subtle sound, like hospital sounds that come through.
Right.
And they're not, you know, I've listened to that story a number of times. And, you know, I've never really thought about that, you know, and yet I feel like I can feel the ICU, you know, feel that hospital room. And that's what it does, is it really puts you right in that space.
We're lucky in a different way as well. And I say about this technology that goes into creating this sound, there's also been a shift in the culture in that you have sort of, we've become a headphones nation. And if you put on your headphones, I've got you in a different way than any radio producer of yore has ever had. Now you're in our world, and what we're trying to do is go ahead and take up every, you know, every possibility of that, because the last thing we want you to do was do this.
I'm reminded, when I think of sound on radio shows, what I often think of with the sound effects is sort of the Prairie Home Companion, clippity-cloppity, clippity-clop, right? So how do you go from that to what you do? Is your team using totally different techniques? Is it an aesthetic difference? What's the difference?
Yeah, it's definitely an aesthetic difference, for sure. But it just depends on the story. And I think the radio producers, the audio engineers that work with the show right now are just great geniuses. And so a lot of my job is oftentimes to get out of the way. And it used to be, like, when Roman and I first started the show, I would do a lot of the score. We all had to score each other's pieces and everything like that. And what I found is that oftentimes I could score someone else's piece better than they could, and they could score mine better than I could, because we're hearing different things. And to give a story, like, we talked about this in the book, to give your story to somebody, I just worked on this story, you go ahead and score it. Don't screw it up. I just worked really hard on that. Don't screw it up. That's especially because it's so fast. We don't have a lot of time, and you're not ready to give it away yet. But developing the mindset, it's like, okay, this is yours now. Go and do with it. Interpret this different. You're going to interpret it differently than I would. And I think that it just really helps make the story more broadly appealing.
Collaboration is key.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And with these guys, I think, in particular in the beginning, it was just me, Glenn, and Mark. And Mark did a lot of the scoring and set the template for a lot of the style of that Foley and that cinematic sound. And he had no baggage from radio whatsoever. And it was, I think, really important to that show. Like, I think that was really critical. And I remember him using music in ways that I was just like, we don't do it that way, you know? And he was right, because that was, and they were finding a new way. And so that's why it's still a joy to listen to Snap Judgment. And I've worked, Pat Mesiti-Miller, one of your guys who does a lot of your sound design, did a recent piece for us, because we just wanted a little extra edge. It was it had these underwater scenes, and we just felt like he could really make it sing. And I got the thing back is like 22 tracks of buses of this going to this and this going to this. And it was a terrifying octopus of a session to figure out. But they have that every episode, every story. It's really amazing.
Thank you, Borman. because I can't do it anymore. The truth of the matter is what he just mentioned by Pat Mesiti-Miller, who's the head of our sound, I just can't do it. I can't do it as well as he could. I used to be able to come in and act like I knew what was happening, I'm the boss, man. Those days are over. Don't tell Pat that.
You're listening to Snap Judgment's Glenn Washington, 99% Invisible's Roman Mars, and cartoonist and writer Jessica Abel, whose book is Out on the Wire, The Storytelling Secrets of the New Masters of Radio, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So, Roman, coming from Snap, and what was your vision for the sound?
Well, I mean, there are a few things. I mean, the reason why 99PI exists a little bit was because I was a reporter for a long time, and one of the things I loved about Snap was it sort of stretched me and turned me into a pure storyteller, but I'm just didactic by nature, and I like reporting.
Didactic by nature.
Yeah. And I missed... just explaining things. I like explainers. That's just what I like to do. And so I started creating these little stories, and they're not really stories. That's the secret to 99% Invisible, is that it's not really stories.
They sure sound like stories.
Well, they have a beginning, middle, and end. And sometimes they have story structure and characters the way normal stories do. But they're often just about ideas and concepts, especially in the beginning. They were like 4 minutes long. So it was just like an idea, a couple of nested anecdotes, and then maybe something funny. And then we got out. We were done. I say we. At the time, it was just me. and then as it developed and we added people, and you know, Sam and Katie and Avery came, they have a story sense. They want to tell stories too, but they love the explainers. And so a lot of the design is kind of trying to fool you into thinking it's a story when it's just like a random assortment of things about a subject. And so the rhythm of it.
No, the thing of it is that he's absolutely right, and I can see how being in a Snap situation would have been so difficult for Roman.
It was joyful. I loved it. But it was a very different style.
It's a very different style. I think what is really, really important. I mean, I obviously deeply respect this brother for lots of different reasons. And when we talk about different things that we prefer in storytelling, that's not to disparage anyone else's style. I don't think there's enough styles of storytelling that are out there. And there is so much room for other people to leave their mark right now. Mm-hmm. But the difference right now that we're talking about is very, very, it's really built into radio right now. What Roman is saying is he's going to explain these things to people, and he does such a beautiful job of it. I just listened to that thing going to the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah.
Again, it was just beautiful. And for us, we would have to actually have a mic on that guy's face before we do that story. And so, because we want to be really, really close. And the last thing I want is an expert to come and tell me what the story means.
And I love experts. I remember our first argument about a piece was this one about the end of the online world, the Sims world.
Yeah.
And I wanted that Stanford guy in there.
Yeah.
And you did not want him in there at all.
No. No. If you haven't heard it, it's one of the most beautiful pieces. It's called Game Over, that Roman Mars did for Snap and for 99% Invisible as well. But it's a beautiful piece. Oftentimes, this is what I think about storytelling in general. I will say, this is not the case with Roman. But general and public, and especially public media storytelling, is that we get in the way of our own spell casting. That storytelling itself is you're telling the story, and we get into it, and you're there, and there's so many ways to screw it up. And one of the ways that is traditionally done is just right when you're feeling it, just right when you're doing it, I get it, they bring out an egghead. A professor so-and-so from such-and-such university to explain me what you just heard. And it drives me nuts. It drives me nuts. Because I think it's a problem within our field in that we don't trust our own storytellers. We don't feel oftentimes that a regular person essentially can make news. And his perspective is valid. And what we're trying to do a lot at SNAP is say, let's get rid of the academics, the big guys, the rhetoricians, everything like that, and let's focus on this one person's story from their perspective and give it as much attention and weight as we can. Now, I say that to say that a lot of times people mess that up. A lot of times they don't. They get it right, and oftentimes what Roman does actually is get eggheads to tell stories that are interesting. I don't know how he does it, because I can't do it.
Well, that's a lot. To circle back to the sound design, that's a lot of what I'm trying to do. So I try to create this space, and the miking and the intimacy of that space is about you feeling those things, even though it isn't a plot-driven story. It's sort of an examination of an idea. And so it kind of seduces you into caring about these things the way you would in a really riveting story that is sort of naturally there where you're driven by plot. And so that's part of what those tricks are about. And a lot of it is the rhythm of, and this is something that I totally took from Radiolab, that rhythm of making it interesting to the ear by having me come in, reporter come in, the subject come in, back and forth, and then sort of like the interviewee talks to the reporter talks to me, and I talk to you. And there's something about that connection between me and you, the listener, that is what I'm trying to create there when I don't have something as life or death, like that happens on his show.
It's something that like showed up in your show, and also in the book it shows up in It's Planet Money. And it's Radiolab, and all three are like shows that are essentially about ideas, right? Yep. Essentially about, and there's plenty of stories to tell. I mean, you run down the storytelling aspect, but it's like often it's the story of discovery, or it's the story of how this came
totally.
To be, or there's.
I mean, when I say there's no story, I'm.
You mean there's no protagonist?
I mean, it's a little bit different than the typical story.
But this is what I struggle with all the time, trying to explain. You know, like with this book, there's no protagonist. It's the story of how you make stories, which is an idea. But you can do it.
Yeah.
And it can be awesome.
So were you making the show and then you kind of realized, oh, when it kind of happens this way, it works the best? Or did you go in very intentionally thinking, I think, let's try this?
I mean, the thing was that at the stage as I started 99, I was really intentional about it. I don't mean to make it sound canned or designed to an extent that makes it phony. But I was like, I want to be 40% Radiolab, 40% Memory Palace, 10%. I had this idea of like, what would work for this type of subject? And, you know, and it was because I'd made radio for 10 years up at that point. Like, it was my little project to see if all these things that I had been working on came together in this way. I think that the show has gotten better. It's been going for 5 years now. The show has gotten better. But I think you hear the nature of the show from the very beginning. It's changed a lot and developed mainly because the staff is so good that it's just gotten so much better because of them. But I think you feel the bones of it are right there from episode one. So.
And Glenn, is there your SNAP formula, has that changed over the years?
No. I think much of the Roman, I mean, we want to get better, and we certainly, I hope, we're doing that. SNAP was actually born in a lot of ways as a reaction to what I was hearing, as I told you before. This idea, especially that the communities I knew anything about weren't being represented, I thought, fairly in public media or any media. I thought that the spell casting was being broken just ridiculously, randomly, for no reason. And I also think this is it. This is what happened. This is what happened in public media. Thanks to Jessica's book and other things, really having to do with Ira, all goes back to Ira. Ira came up with a template of what public media stories should sound like. And it goes like this. First, I'm going to give you a little bit of exposition. I'm going to give you a little story. I'm going to give you a little reflection. Story, reflection. Story, reflection. Conclusion, bow. That's This American Life. But the problem that I had with this oftentimes was that it put the producer or the reporter in a position to judge or from a godlike position on everyone who was involved in the story. And I wanted to see what would it be if we moved the focus down so that the storyteller, whoever lived this thing, could tell their own story all the way through and not be judged necessarily by some Eastern educated reporter. Now.
Play into the hometown audience.
Western educated reporters,
yeah.
Too.
At the end of a piece, the end of a story is magic. There's a gap. There's a gap at the end of every single story. And this gap is where you either kind of nod to the story and go on about your business, or you take this story internal to yourself. And again, we screw this up all the time in public media. And what I wanted to do there, instead of, if I tell you at the end of a story what a story means, I rob you of that story. I rob you of your ability to take this to internally. If instead I find a way to almost to finish this story so that you feel emotionally satisfied, but ask almost as many questions, not answering any questions. Life isn't like that. I want to, at the end of the piece, have the protagonist doing whatever it is they do. Essentially, I will lead you to where they are, but I'm not going to make you think anything about it. I want to end the story essentially with a question. And if you end the story with a question, now it's your story. You own that story, and you're thinking about it in a different way than if I told you what it meant. And so it's a different type of a story structure, and it's one that I'm actually pretty adamant about. In fact, the LA Times said I'm combative. About it. That's how they do black people. But a combative storyteller. But it's really important to us, actually. But what does it say? We do work with the cross section of America. Yeah, we try to do that. America, listen, the high idea of having, listen what happened, listen, there's a show on the radio where someone said, someone said something, and then what we do in public media is we interpret for our public media audience what this lower socioeconomic person just said, so that make sure we're all the in crowd together, me and you. I hate that one because America is smart enough to understand its own America. We are smart enough to speak to each other and understand what we're saying to each other. We do not need to be interpreted to, and it really gets in the way of the overall narrative that we're trying to make oftentimes. And that's, again, one of those points where you stop the spell casting and you just mess it up for no reason. And I say that, I mean, with love. Because these are the people who taught me, I mean, how much I do care about what stories sound like and bringing other communities into it. And I know now, I know for a fact, the show plays well in West Texas, in deep Mississippi. You can play a story from San Francisco about a transsexual stripper in deep Mississippi, and nobody calls and does anything about it because it's a story that is coming from someone else's heart to another person. It's not asking for a polemic. It's not political. It's just like, this happened to me. And it's so wonderful that we're able to do this, that especially when you listen to what's happening right now in our political debate, where you have several jackasses right now braying at each other on TV. And we get to actually tell stories, and at the end of it, you know, you've seen this. When you watch Crossfire, and you watch these two idiots yell at each other, and you want to go take a shower. it's happened to all of us. But when you listen to a story, when someone actually says, this is what happened to me, and this is what I did next, and you get a picture of a world that you've never seen before, oftentimes, if it's told well and done properly, you don't want to just bathe. You want to do something. You want to get up from that chair and participate. You want to go see the experience that they're talking about. I remember listening to a story recently on another show. Now I want to go see a Mexican wrestling match because that was a pretty cool story. I want to see how it works in real life. This is the power. I'm going on, but this is... it's really important right now that we understand that this form can really be inclusive and get into each other's head, because what's lacking in this country right now, I think, is empathy. And what storytelling does is bridge it.
I feel really great right now because I feel like I actually captured some of that in the book. Like I got it right. And in fact, in episode 3 of Out on the Wire podcast, yes, there's some quotes from you about this exact thing.
All right, on.
Yeah.
We were going to talk about Roman storytelling, how you effectively...
That's uncanny, isn't it?
How do you do it right? How do you do the explainy thing right and not, you know, in a way that makes Glenn...
irritated?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the thing is the tone of the show, even though it's about ideas and objects... In fact, one of the things in the very beginning was the catchphrase I had was 99% invisible, nothing personal. because I really wanted it to be about ideas, but I wanted those ideas and I wanted the objects and the things that we cover, which, because we cover design, so it's really the built world in every way. But it's about finding the humanity in the built world and recognizing all these things that you take for granted, they were made for you by someone who fundamentally cared about you. And that's the feeling of the show, is about infusing all the objects around us with the humanity of intent. And so that is the spell that we try to cast. And it isn't about personal storytelling in that way, although sometimes those show up, of course. It's really about creating this space where you can enjoy and wonder about the world. Because this is the trajectory of the show is, I mean, it did that to me as the maker of the show. I became more aware, I became more empathic, I became just more sensitive to all these things in the world. And it seems to work. We never talked about that as the intent. It was never like part of a mission statement that went out. People just gathered that from the shows. And so you create that space through showing joy, exhibiting joy, exhibiting some kind of passion. I do go in and interpret things for people, but a lot of it is because to make these ideas come to life, you need geeky enthusiasm. And most of the time, the subject that you're interviewing can provide that. And if they don't provide it, oh, I'll provide it. because I can get into anything. Like, I love a lot of things. And so, and when we're doing a story, I'm the biggest fan of that idea or concept as it goes on. So that's very much told from a point of view. Now, the point of view has expanded as the voices have expanded, but we still come at it from as a design column in certain ways. It certainly has facts, but we do provide a perspective. And I like that. I was free to do that for the first time because I'd been a reporter for a long time and that wasn't allowed. And I remember even in the beginning days of Snap Judgment, you know, we'd present a story. This is before any relationship with NPR had happened or anything like that. And they'd come back with their journalism questions, like, did this happen like this? What time of day? You know, like that sort of thing. And we would go, it's not really that kind of story.
Drive me nuts.
And so So I like the role as a commentator. I mean, we really play with it. I mean, the reason the show is great in this way that it's a series over time. So no one episode has to represent our philosophy of design or our philosophy of radio or anything. You're just looking to, like, do the next one, and that has a little different feel, and the next one has a little different feel. And over time, this, like, regression plot is formed, and you're like, you draw a line, and that is the thesis of 99% Invisible. And I love that as an ongoing series. Like, that was totally new to me, because these big shows that take their, like, five stories, they're really hard to do. It was really nice to have one that was like, this is very unusual for us. Let's just put it out there and see what it does. Because we know the next week it'll be something new.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features Snap Judgment's Glenn Washington, 99% Invisible's Roman Mars, and cartoonist and writer Jessica Abel, whose book is Out on the Wire, The Storytelling Secrets of the New Masters of Radio. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So what both of you are describing in your shows, it would be really easy to do, to make terrible, terrible shows from the concepts that you're, right? Like, you're exceptional at what you do, and that's why it's good. And I think that...
Oh, we've done that, too.
You know, I feel like if I tried to make one of your shows, like,
that's the feeling.
I would be on the floor.
That's Tuesday for us.
Yeah.
So let's...
That's me and me. That was my method of coming up with stories at that point, was to lie on the floor and groan for a few weeks. Which is why doing that book was such an important turning point for me, because Ira had a system. He had whatever, it didn't apply exactly to what I was doing, but it was a system, and it had parts, and there were, like, there's an order to things and all this stuff, and it was like the beginning of a whole, you know, 10-year like investigation into how I wanted to tell stories and how I wanted to teach other people to tell stories. And all of it is about staying off that rug. it's such a, and I feel like still, you know, I always have a rug in my studio just in case. And I feel like everybody I talk to practically in the radio book goes through that stage, not literally on the rug, but like that feeling of like, oh my God, how am I going to get this thing done? And I don't understand how this is going to go. And I'm crappy at my job and the story sucks. And
do you
guys have that? Because I didn't ask you about it.
Sure. I mean, the thing is you have a deadline and so you just do it.
Yes, you do. Yes, that's true. But
yeah, no, you feel them. You feel them. I feel them less because I pay other people to feel that for me. But
oh, I'd like to do that.
but it is, you do have those moments, but one of the things you do is you just soldier through it and realize that most of it is just, I don't believe in inspiration. You just do things.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
The what makes the show happen is ass power. And by that, I mean you have to sit your ass down there until it's done.
Well, that's why I think I was on the rug, is because I was waiting for inspiration. And not because I wanted to wait for inspiration, because I didn't know what else to do. I didn't have a system. Like, I didn't have a way to go about it. You know what I mean? I think I knew even then that inspiration was bunk, you know, in that way. But it's like, what do you, how, you know? And this is one of the parts of the book that I felt the most strongly about including, is this idea of the German forest that comes from Jad Abumrad. And he calls it the German forest. Everybody goes, why German? And it's because he came up with this idea when he was working on a story about Wagner. So... thus German. So I just go around calling it the dark forest so it's a little bit more clear. But this idea of, like, it's not that you have no ideas, not that you're just waiting for inspiration, but you have, like, done a bunch of work, You have all this stuff. You have the material. You have all your research, but you don't. You don't know what the path is. You know, you have this stuff, and you don't know how to put it in order. I feel like that's as much of a. It's like maybe even like a greater problem with your kind of stories, Roman, than yours, Glenn. Because Glenn, your stories are often like they're chronological. You know, you've got. You know, you're telling a story in a certain order because it happened in that order. And maybe you change things around a little bit for suspense, but basically, you know, there's something suggested to you from the beginning. But when you're talking about an idea or an abstract concept, it's like, you know.
Yeah. I mean, the way that I do it is I just pick my favorite part. It's not the beginning. It's not the middle. It's the end. It's just something that I'm inspired to do. It could be a piece of music that I was like, I really want to talk over that piece of music, and I'll just start there, and just whatever it is, and then it starts to form, because, I mean, I'm really adamant about the thing lives in audio, and so it's always reacting to the audio that comes before it or after it, and so once you start with one part, it just starts to coalesce, because you're going to have to react to the thing that the person said, and it can't be dry, and it can't be just the idea of what they said. It really is about the feeling and the emotion of what they said in some way. And then it just all starts to form, and then it all starts to form, and it's massive. And then you just start cutting it. It's just like, it just works. And the other luxury that I've had recently is, because there's enough ass power on the show, We if one isn't working at all, we just stop. That I didn't have that luxury 5 years ago. If I started a story, it was getting done. Like it was going to be on the air. But now we just, if we get to a point, it's just not, we're not feeling anything for it. It just goes. Sometimes you just can't work your way out of it. And so it's a healthy thing. When you're killing stories, you know that you're doing it right, actually. I think it's a good sign. Don't do less. You should let them go.
So I wanted to talk about the edit, which I think you started.
This was
we started to.
That's a Glenn quote right there.
I think what I was talking about was that because the show is so moves so quickly. We have to, you just worked on this thing and you've given birth to this story. This is a brand new thing. What do you think about my brand new story baby thingy? And we have to say, your baby's ugly. And that stinks for everybody and it hurts people's feelings. But it's a weekly show. It's something that has to happen. And especially as a new producer, it's really tough to get that type of feedback and not take it personally.
How long are some of are the edits?
This morning, for example.
Yes, this morning. A session can go for 2 or 3 hours. But, I mean, at its core, what you're doing is saying, let's give you've got a bunch of champion storytellers in the room. Let's listen to it early and see if there's anything that comes out and if we can fix it. And we're encouraged, like here, to say, it's not just my product. It's everybody's project. Cut this story to ribbons. If something's bad, go after it. And that can, especially when you're the lead producer, that's painful. Because, thank God, the reason why it's painful is because they care. They care about the product. They care about the story, and they care about the people that are going to listen to it.
Even if the story's good, that, you know, it's not just like, oh, let's, you know, take apart the bad stories and put them, you know, like this is my biggest sort of revelation from working on this book, because for some reason I kind of missed the importance of this stage when I did Radio and Illustrated Guide. And I realized, you know, doing the book and after the book that this is something I do in my own practice. Like I talk to my husband, Matt, who's also a cartoonist, and get feedback from him, and he helps me work through problems, he critiques stuff. But also it's what I taught in my classes. You know, when I would teach a class, and I call it critiquing, not edits, which can be confusing for people who are not in the radio world, because it doesn't mean literally editing. It means that critique process. But that's what I teach in my classes. I would have you know, this, I would put stuff up on the walls, and we'd all talk about it, and we'd try to be as honest as possible and fix things and all that other stuff. And I would always say to my students, this is the best time of your life is right now, because you have all these people here who care and who are paying attention and who are going to make you better. And it may be painful, but you've got to listen. You've got to pay attention to what they're saying. They don't necessarily have it exactly right, but you've got to listen, because this is where you understand what's coming through of your intention, like what of the things that you're trying to do is actually happening in other people's minds.
But just to be clear, we're still talking about 2 to 3 hours of the knives being out on someone's...
Not necessarily the same story. This is for a story session. And we have, and I've learned to break that up a little bit. Yeah.
But I mean, you know, like I've talked to plenty of people at different shows, and like they can do... It's easy to have an entire afternoon on one 20-minute story. Like, that can happen.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think weekly for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, when I talked to you, you were basically alone. You were still, I mean, Sam was still across the country.
Yeah.
But you were saying, I really miss this. This is, you know, the thing that you wanted to incorporate.
Yeah, I mean, at the time, I mean, I was lucky that I'd been edited so much that I was functioning for a short while as my own editor. This is not recommended. But I just had enough, and the stakes were just so low that it didn't really matter all that much. I mean, but now Katie Mingle came in. We call her the cutter. and she really has a sense. I think she fundamentally believes in her core that every story would be better 2 or 3 minutes shorter. Every story. And her goal is to make it as good as possible. Right. And she's very compassionate about it. For the most part. but we have huge edit sessions, and we do it on paper a couple of times, and we listen to it. And it's an arduous process.
Yeah.
But it's a great process.
You know, if you have the cutter on your staff, perhaps you have, you know, the sort of expert help you need to make all those things work. But like in many cases, you just have people who are like, well, I don't really know, but they're helping you understand what's working, what's not.
Yeah, we don't always know the answer, but we try to figure it out, which is why some of those sessions are so epic. I need them in a lot of ways, but in particular, I'm like a huge radio fan. And so if I really like something, I can just bliss out, just like I'll keep listening to it. And so I kind of don't have the temperament to be a very good editor. And so it's really good to have people listen with you, and also to play your stuff out loud. Like, the key to that is not just what people tell you, is that when you hear your work in front of other people and there's something wrong with it, you feel it when you're in the room. Like, my ears get red and my head gets really hot, you know, and I just feel miserable, and they don't have to say anything, and I'll know exactly what has to go.
This is something I actually stole from This American Life, is this whole idea. Oftentimes, when you are editing and you go through a piece and you're not quite sure what it is, it's just not clean enough, it's not perfect enough, it's not right enough, there's something wrong, I'll be the jerk that just do this better.
That is totally an Ira thing.
Yeah, do that part better.
Do a better job.
Do a better job right here. And it's not like it's not like you screwed it up necessarily. It's just that there's something not clean about it. And they don't appreciate it. But it's like what Roman was saying. This you get to the point where it's not hitting a rhythm, a beat, it's not clean enough, it's not whatever it is, it's just not working, but you know that it's whatever they're doing, it's necessary. So fix it. And oftentimes it's the worst edit, but it's the best because you can fix it your way. And if I tell them how to fix it, I might be wrong, but I know that there's a problem.
You know, we were talking about stories about ideas, and so Out on the Wire is a book about ideas. It's a book about concepts and tools and has some stories in it, but basically is about that. But so when I got to the end of it, I was like, well, there's no conclusion. It's just like here's the stuff, you know, I already gave it to you. So the epilogue is more about how it felt for me as the writer to, and the cartoonist, to go through the process of learning all of these things. And then feel like, at the end, that I did emerge from the dark forest, you know, which was very dark and very long period of time. But when I got out the other side, I felt like, wow, I've really, like, I know something new. Like, I've learned something new. And the metaphor of going out on the wire comes from Jay Allison, and he was talking about storytellers on the Moth, and he's talking about editing them, literally editing, not an edit critique. But and he was saying basically he doesn't edit them. All he does is basically take out swear words, and that's pretty much it. Because what he values the most is those moments when people pause, when they hesitate, because those pauses, that it indicates thinking. You know, it shows people struggling with something. And you know, comics and radio are so weirdly parallel in this way, because comics has two tracks that you read them on. You read the words and you read the pictures. And the pictures have a direct line to your subconscious. You understand things about what you're looking at without ever thinking about it. But although radio only has, literally it only has one track in the sense, I mean, has dozens and dozens of tracks, I know, but like when it comes into your ears, it's coming in, you know, just those two earbuds. But at the same time, it has two tracks, or I see it as having two tracks, because it has the sort of vocal, narrative, interview stuff that's going on, and then it has the nonverbal sound, which can be as complex as what you guys build, but it can be as simple as breath. You know, it can be as simple as just, you know, little background noises and just noise in the tape, and that we absorb all those things and understand them, and it's part of the emotional resonance of audio, you know. So when Jay was talking about going out on the wire, he was saying, like, people have to take that risk. They have to allow themselves to be vulnerable. And that moment when they pause and they think and they consider whether they're really going to do this thing, are they really going to get out there and take a risk, that's going out on the wire. And I thought that is, like, you know, when I was looking for a title for the book, I just thought that it is the essential truth of all of these great producers and the pieces that they make, is that they have to take some kind of emotional risk themselves, or, you know, they have to care enough about what they're doing and get out on the wire with it. And that's what makes it really great.
Thank you.
Vina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guests were Snap Judgment's Glenn Washington, 99% Invisible's Roman Mars, and cartoonist and writer Jessica Abel, whose book is Out on the Wire, The Storytelling Secrets of the New Masters of Radio. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.